Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Mangan Talks TV. This is our season two coverage of Severance. We are on the penultimate episode. I am your host, Lee. I'm joined by my co-host, Spencer. Spencer, how are you?
In a better mood already to be here talking Severance.
I was really excited to talk about this one. And you could tell my voice is still a little bit sideways, but it's probably interesting to listen to these podcasts back to back because I start out really bad, a little better next week, a little better this week. Hopefully when you hear me next week, it'll be like standard Lee. But we are here. We're going to talk some Severance. It's the penultimate episode of season two titled After Hours. Spencer, what'd you think of the episode?
I thought this was a return to form. Not that the last, as we discussed it, not the last episode was bad, but it did feel like kind of the weakest episode of Severance, certainly maybe for this season, maybe in general. This felt like a much more, we're back up into a quality average or maybe even a step above average Severance episode in terms of my overall level of enjoyment at it. We were debating whether this would be like a Game of Thrones episode 9 or a different like setting up in a climactic episode 10 kind of thing. It feels more like a setup episode ultimately, but it was crisp. It was moving things along. It had exciting moments. It had very well done visuals and quality dialogue and a dozen quotable lines that I've got written down here. I thought it was a good and enjoyable episode.
Yeah. So here's what I'd like to say about that is I think that, you know, we started doing the podcast with Game of Thrones. We cover House of the Dragon. I think that the Westeros shows have no idea how to do penultimate episodes or finales. I think they're completely screwed up. I think this is a proper representation of what a penultimate episode should be. I don't think as much as I enjoyed the episode nines of Game of Thrones, there were some good ones. Your biggest episode, your biggest plot mover, the biggest, most exciting thing that you do, I don't think should be the episode before your finale. It should be your finale.
Agreed.
And, you know, then you switch to House of the Dragon season two, where the finale felt like a penultimate episode. This felt like what that finale of season two of House of the Dragon was, which is set the table, set the board. And now we go into all these plot movements, right? I mean, so much was set up this episode that it really made me excited about next week. And I felt like it's exactly what I want normally out of a penultimate episode.
100%. I mean, this gave us the idea of where all the pieces are on the board now moving into checkmate or however else the season resolves. It was very interesting to see where they've gone with some of these plot lines. It's interesting that me in particular, but you as well, have been proven outright wrong about where a few of these plot lines seem to be resolving, which always fun to be guessing when it comes to this show. And yeah, it was fun occasionally with Game of Thrones that, oh my God, the episode 9 is going to be so exciting. Then we're going to see the aftermath in episode 10. It was a different way of experiencing the show, but to see proper build, proper flow going into what's clearly going to be an exciting finale, it has left me all the more excited in a way I should be going into what may be another 3-year break to this show.
Yeah, it'll probably be, I mean, they take a while, right? And if it's okay, it probably won't be as long because this was impacted from the writer's strike. Mm-hmm. So whatever this was, you know, back out 6-8 months or whatever, and that's likely what we can expect for season 3. But I like it too. I like that the penultimate episode sets the table. You know, there's actually one scene I want to talk about before we get into housekeeping.
Go on.
As at the end of the episode where Mark and his MVP sister, I mean, just the greatest.
I'm in love with Devin after this episode. I mean,
you're
going to fight me for her affections? This is what we're going to do
think
now?
She's
square
fantastic.
Off, my friend.
Fantastic. She's wonderful. MVP sister and Mark are walking in to talk to Cobelvig. Let's assume, just for sake of conversation, that they filmed the scene, right? The way they go in and they start talking. And let's say it's 10 minutes. Next week's episode's much longer than this week's episode. They probably had an editing decision on moving that conversation to the back end of this episode. I like ending it on the tease of you don't know what they're going to talk about.
Yes.
I really appreciated that choice as much as I want to see that. That should be in the finale. That should make you want to watch next week. It was a great ending point, I felt like, for the episode.
I will say, if we are engaged in some manner of heel face turn when it comes to Cobelvig, could we get her some form of counselor on how to appear less menacing? Like, you're setting up a conversation with a person who has no reason to trust you, has all reasons to distrust you. And you've chosen as your backlining the flames of hell in an otherwise dark, what looks like hunting lodge kind of room. In terms of overall presence and what you want to present to the other person to set the right tone for the conversation, I think it was an interesting choice.
Yeah, it's a trust but verify situation. Like, I'm going to go ahead and talk to you, but like, I do not know if the trust level is at 100%. So let's do a little housekeeping. Last week at the end of the episode, I talked about some feedback we'd gotten from our listeners that, you know, happy that we're back on the air, sending in very supportive messages, very cool. But also referencing that we had a previous format where we would go through the script line by line, do much longer recaps and really break the episode down line by line. And that some listeners have communicated that they did like that format. And kind of ask questions like, is that going away? Or we ever see that again? So Spencer and I got together. We got agreement. My camp sent a contract to his camp. We back and forth red lines all week. We finally got it signed about an hour before the podcast.
I killed the first round of advisors, as was tradition.
Yeah, and stepped in, did it himself. And
as a true leader should.
We have agreement that next week for the finale of Severance Season 2, Spencer and I will go back to the old format for one episode. Mm-hmm. We're not promising to do this every week on our coverage going forward. I think that we need to ratchet back for the sustainability of us doing this, the sheer time that we're committing to some of these podcasts. But we can do it occasionally or for particular series. And we have decided that for the finale of Severance, which will be an extra long episode, which we'll talk about in just a second, be an extra long episode, we're going to do the line-by-line recap of the episode. So we hope that gets you excited about watching the episode and then coming here and digesting it with us. And we hope it's a little bit of a breadcrumb, a little bit of an olive branch out to the fans who miss the old format.
To translate for Lee, buckle the fuck up, people, for a 4-hour proper episode of the Magnum Talks podcast.
Yeah, my voice is getting better at just the right time because it's going to be used next week. We will be talking a lot because the episode is supposed to be what, Spencer, like
75 minutes. 76, according to Ben Stiller. We'll see. Everybody lies about their episode lengths. I suspect that's going to include recap and end credits, but it seems like it's going to be an extra long episode of Severance.
So let me say this about that, because you mentioned that before we started recording. I watch this show, the first time I watch it through, I watch it on a treadmill and I'm running, right? Mm-hmm. And I like to run. It's a great thing for me to do. It's good for my physical and mental health, but it is still very difficult to do. And I watch how long I've got to go on the episode very, very closely. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. For this episode, I looked at the episode. It said runtime 44 minutes. I clicked on it. And the actual file that was playing from Apple TV was like 56 minutes or something, 55. And at 44, it did end the programming and then went to credits and then the after show discussion. So I'm apt to believe them that it's actually 75 because they're not including that in the runtime. I can verify.
I am burned by other shows that we have watched that have done everything in their power to exaggerate or hide what the episode length was. I'll accept your point. This show may be better.
Another piece of housekeeping is people have asked, hey, does this mean that you're not covering any other shows anymore? You know, we were in the middle of Silo. We did not cover Silo Season 2. Spencer and I do not have an answer for you on Silo Season 2, but we will consider going back and doing that at some point. We did hear that Ted Lasso Season 4 has been greenlit. Spencer groaned into his phone and was in a bad mood for days. Did not like the idea, but we will prioritize covering that if and when that comes out.
It was one of those moments that just proves that Lee treats me every now and then like a very stubborn horse that he's trying to break to the saddle, of where he led with Ted Lasso Season 4 is coming back, and then he immediately followed with, don't worry, there'll be sweets and tea. It's like he knew how to market this in a way that I would find tolerable.
So we will definitely prioritize doing Ted Lasso Season 4 when that comes. It's a long ways off. But for now, Wheel of Time Season 3 dropped this last week, Spencer. Very exciting over on Amazon. Wheel of Time Season 3 has hit the first three episodes. So myself, Sarah, BJ, Bree, I'm announcing now, we'll be back to cover that show. BJ and Bree have had a pretty serious life event since the last time we recorded. They had a child, so they've got an infant in the house, a small baby. We will not be able to record on a perfect schedule. So we will not be, what I say that, I mean, we will not be able to do week by week. We will record every week, but we are not going to be able to catch up because the way that they did Wheel of Time is they dropped the first three episodes at once, right? So we're not going to be able to right now do the first three episodes, get that out, and then follow 4, 5, 6 as it drops. But what we're going to do is start our review of episode 1 this week, and then the following week, episode 2, 3. So we'll end up being a few, we'll be doing our coverage a few weeks after the finale ends, because we will cover episodes 1, 2, and 3 in 3 weeks instead of all at once, like Amazon dropped it on us. But I can say my early thoughts on this are that Wheel of Time season 3 looking pretty good. Very excited to cover that show.
As a person who is one book and two chapters into the series, I will get there eventually.
Yeah. Well, you got to make a decision. If you're going to read the books, you'll end up probably watching the show in 2045. Cause my goodness, there's a lot of books. All right. Let's get to what people are here for. They're here to hear us talk Severance. So Spencer, you said you liked the episode. Tell us more.
Well, first of all, among the list of questions I never thought we would have answered, why is Helly so angry? Apparently the answer is because she's hangry as shit from what her Audi is doing to her. Because apparently her Audi is doing laps and then viewing adequate post-workout food to be a single egg cut into sixth, and I think she eats maybe a fourth of it. Which is insufficient food, and clearly Helly is just hangry down there on the poor Severance floor. Other things...
Okay, so this show is smart enough, and like we talked about last week, sometimes on the nose enough, that might mean she's pregnant, right? The egg.
That she's just eating the egg whites, or that there is just an egg that's there.
That the egg is symbolic, that they are having her eat this egg as a sort of like a symbolic thing for the audience to know that she's gotten pregnant during one of these rendezvous with Mark.
Possibly so. Could be the case. Okay. The scene did add to my further thoughts that her dad is a lich or some form of undead automaton kind of creature that doesn't need to eat anymore.
What's a lich?
A lich is I'm borrowing from fantasy here, but it's basically a form of a sorcerer that has basically made themselves undead for the purpose of living forever.
Oh, nice. And okay.
The fact that he apparently doesn't feel the need to eat and just wants to watch her eat and drink some weird tea concoction while telling his daughter that he would prefer if he got to watch her eat the eggs raw is all kinds of a weird ass scene, and like every other scene that we've gotten of Jamie in so far.
Him wanting her to eat it raw, could that be related to the pregnancy too?
Like, I don't know what the typical pregnancy, you know, traditions are when it comes to the faith of Kier. I could not tell you. Would not put it past them.
I'm just saying, I think that there's that might be something that they're setting up. I'll tell you this, I don't normally eat breakfast or lunch. Which I know sounds really strange to people. I eat usually about 1,000 calories at dinner, and then I'll snack a little through the night, and sometimes we'll have a light lunch. But that's kind of how I intake food. But that doesn't mean I don't, when people are like going out to breakfast or something, I don't want to go. Like, I want to go and I want to have a cup of coffee and hang out with you all, but I'm probably not going to order any food. So I guess I'm the weird dude. I'm kind of like Jay Megan sometimes. I'm the weird one. He's like, let me watch.
If there is food available.
Don't isolate that.
The man likes to watch. We know this now about Lee. Lee, I'm really glad you had to share these moments with us. Now, you know me. If there is food available, I'm going to engorge in whatever is available, particularly if it's free.
Oh, boy, if it's free. Yeah, yeah. But you do eat breakfast, though, right? You're a breakfast eater.
What I typically do if, like, during an average work day is I will bring a variety of breakfast foods with me and kind of snack on them throughout the day and then eat a larger dinner. If I'm going to do anything like working out, I'm going to eat a healthy breakfast, a healthy lunch, and a healthy dinner. I burn calories like a hummingbird. I'm just not going to have reserves unless I do that.
Can we agree that if you have to drop a meal, it should be lunch?
Lunch is the easiest meal to drop. Yes. Lunch.
Yeah.
Lunch is also like, I know people that like need to take a lunch, I can't function without it. Lunch for me is just an unnecessary break in the flow of the day. Like the idea of taking like a lunch break and doing all that with respect to that, I understand it, but inconvenient for me most of the time.
Yeah, there's a social piece of that when you're working in the office, but I've never really needed that from like a, you know, nutrition or like, a, you know, I can't get the rest of my day unless I have a, some sort of food at lunch. I'll tell you, the decorations of the Egan household.
What do you make of those? Oh, boy.
How would you feel if you got yourself a, you come visit me in North Carolina, you get yourself a Airbnb and it's decorated that way. How do you feel?
I'm still waiting to see the inside of your new house. So I'll find out how you've chosen to decorate and whether it fits the Egan style.
It's incredibly impersonal to the point of being caustic and aggressive.
I always found the term brutalist to be an interesting term to describe an architectural sense. I'm now getting to see it live and understand better why that term is in place.
Yeah, it was tough. Although, you know, the swimming pool there did look pretty nice. Okay, let's move the episode along. We had a pretty big Dylan arc this week.
We did. Our boy Dylan had a rough week on both sides of the personality and person that he is. For one, Gretchen felt the need to fess up as to the affair that she was having, fess up to Audi Dylan about the affair she was having with any Dylan, and then let any Dylan know that she'd done this. And it did not seem like it went particularly well for either of them. I mean, there was no way that was going to work out great. But it was enough that it made Audi Dylan act like any Dylan for a moment in his outrage about what his wife had done. I got his line here. I'm going to go to work and earn a paycheck to feed our children. Will you? And I'm going to respectfully request that you don't follow me and use my own body to fucking cheat on me. Well said, Audi Dylan. Well said. We appreciate your way of expressing things that sounded really any Dylan when you said that.
Isn't it interesting that these revelations flipped any and Audi Dylan? That Audi Dylan got more self-confident, assured, very direct in the response. And any Dylan became this sort of like begging, sobbing mess, this sort of like thing of like this, like for what I think the character wants, the Dylan's wife wants, like unattractive. Like she didn't respond well to that.
Yeah. I mean, working our way through the scene, point number one, I would advise Gretchen strongly that when you are confessing to this kind of mistake, when you're asking for a certain measure, I'm thinking maybe she didn't ask for such actually forgiveness from your husband. Maybe don't open with, this is kind of your fault. She basically said, in terms of explaining what occurred, you've been adrift and he reminds me of how you used to be. That was an extra harsh way to present that point, I felt like.
Yeah, I feel like the sort of, I've cheated, I'm letting you know, but I have my reasons and some of them are related to how you've been treating me. I just feel like that comes later. I don't feel like that's a thing to drop sentences after you say the thing.
Right now, it is, this has happened, I'm really sorry, and now you get to control the tenor of where this conversation goes rather than me. That's the way you handle that. What she said just seemed to make it worse.
I've got 2 points on this. The first is that I thought, we brought this up, because we saw this coming a mile away, that she was going to do this with any Dylan.
Not how it would resolve necessarily, but just the affair would occur.
When we brought it up, we both readily, quickly agreed that this was cheating and moved on. We didn't even, this is cheating, moved on.
No further discussion.
I realized when she came to Audi Dylan and explained it to him, that I don't know that I think it's cheating. Because I was putting myself in Audi Dylan's perspective, and I'm not sure how angry I would have been. Because what she's telling me is, I cheated with you. Like, it's just, you don't remember it, but I sought out you. I was kissing you. I was thinking about you. Like, I understand it's not one or the other, right? This is not black or white. This is a murky situation, but my emotional reaction to it was, this isn't cheating, or at least it's not on the level of going out and finding another person to cheat with.
I understand your point of view. Disagree from where I'm coming from. And one of the main reasons that's driving that for me, though, she treated it like cheating.
She
hid from him. She lied to him. She viewed this as an affair. She viewed it as a different person in some shape or form, or something that reminded her of the old person that she fell in love with. That make I'm not sure how I would respond to that situation. We don't, I've never looked at things from that particular point of view, where I was a multiple personality kind of thing. But the fact that she viewed her actions from that light is going to drive me in that direction.
So it's not nothing, right? I didn't have the reaction of, I wouldn't, Audi Lee wouldn't be high-fiving my partner, right? Hey, good job. Glad you went and did that with my innie. But I just didn't have the emotional reaction that I often do when I put myself in the position of characters who've been cheated on. It was something different for me. And I think that that's the really interesting conversation that they're starting for the viewer with this entire plot line, along with, you know, so there's that. And then also the relationship of the Eddie to the Audi because of what we've talked about with Dylan's personality.
And like you referenced, it drove each to be more like the other, to drive, emphasizing the common traits and the ability of each one to be the other, because they are not even two halves of the same person. They are the same person, just with different life experiences allowing themselves to express themselves differently. Of where Audi Dylan became more aggressive, more determined. She wasn't certain what Audi Dylan was going to go and do, because he was going off with a head of steam threatening to basically kill, terminate, however you wish to refer to it, any Dylan. And then any Dylan... Let's review. Much more deferential, much more begging, practically, in terms of needing something from another person rather than headstrong, driven, commanding the conversation. Cut up the ring that he was about to give her. That was one of his cut-up finger traps, right?
It was. Yeah, that's tough emotionally.
That was incredibly symbolic. What he previously viewed his life around, his goals, his driving force, he destroyed for the sake of something different, something outside of anything he'd known before. And it failed. It failed hard. And then, because of that failure, effectively Dylan, who very pointedly got Irv not to do what Dylan chose to do, effectively committed suicide this episode, in his perspective, in response to what occurred, right?
I mean, that's the question. I think that...
I don't think he actually did, but I think he willingly walked to death. Whether that comes to pass or not, that's outside of his hands, but he chose to self-terminate.
He did. And what was interesting is how that was handled versus Helly's 1,100 requests to leave and never come back were handled last season. Mm-hmm. It seemed like Milchick took this very seriously. There was a form. Who knew there was a form? And there's like reasons for wanting to terminate.
check.
He lets him go to the elevator as if he's made the decision. I mean, how many times did Helly go, I want to leave and never come back? And, you know, either Milchick or Cobell were like, yeah, good luck with that. Like, you're definitely coming back. Like, no chance of that happening. So they took it seriously. I agree with you that he was taking the action. And really confusing and disappointing for any Dylan. I've talked a lot about any Dylan's leadership, what he means to the severed group, the group there in, what are they called? DL, what was the name of their department?
Macro Data Refinement.
Macro Data Refinement. That's right. Macro Data Refinement. And he seems to be eschewing all leadership and just sort of collapsing over this one disappointment. And it was very bizarre to me. I didn't really understand the decision from the character.
It caught me off guard. I can kind of see it to a certain degree based on the show's themes of what is it you are fighting for? What is it you are working for? What is your purpose? Of where every one of the purposes that Dylan has built his house of cards around has been pulled out from under him now. Of where previously it was the job and being good at the job. But now the job is a trick. The job is misleading. The job is controlling. It's not something he can dedicate his life to. Then it was his coworkers. But Mark's missing. Irv's dead from his perspective. And so a lot of that has been pulled away from him. So instead of that, and in some ways in betrayal of that, he instead dedicated the concept to Audi life. I'll find something out there that I can aspire to. If I dedicate myself to work, they're giving me this new perk, and that's worth it. I'll fight for that. And now that door's seemingly closed to him, despite his efforts, despite committing to it in a way that he never thought before, never thought he would care before. So at least this episode, it is a man looking at things as if there are no further options and no further purpose. He's wrong, but he's in an emotional state of where everything else that he has previously built and structured and strived for has now been pulled out from under him, and he's left grasping at straws.
Yeah, I guess maybe I misread the character, because I thought he was taking his role as sort of mother hen of this group.
I agree.
More personally, You know, that the scene with Irv where he was trying to help Irv. When this doesn't work out for him, he goes and he sits with Helly in the break room and he is awful. He's absolutely awful to her in a way that I just did not expect him to do when faced with disappointment. I thought that he would retreat back into the comfort of the role, which is we have to take care of each other down here. And I'm somebody who looks out for my friends' backs.
We always kind of thought that Helly would be like, not necessarily the Lancer, but more the person that was providing the fire that would inspire the other leader in some shape or form, that, you know, she'd be too headstrong necessarily to be the one leading the cause. But literally at this point, she's it. She's at the end of this episode, she's the only person left on the floor, which made, as you said, that conversation between her and Dylan just so rough. I got written down here, but him telling her, you know, it's your fault we're all down here, right? She says, no, it's not. And if we're so different from our outies, then how come we couldn't tell when you were gone? And she has a great rejoinder. She says, Irving could. But then Dylan drops the most mean line he possibly could of where he says, Mark couldn't. To the point that even when he walks away, he has to say in a way that, you know, means nothing, offers no emotional value whatsoever. Sorry, I guess I'm an asshole down here too.
Yeah. And, you know, I've talked about how great I think Britt Lower is in this series and her reaction to that, because that Helly does not want to break down over something like that. She's an extremely strong-willed person. But that is such a cutting line that you see her start to break, but trying to hold it together. And it just seems so realistic to me how Britt Lower did that scene where it was like, she's like, almost like she's hitting the chest and she arches her back a little and then looks like she's just trying to hold it as he gets up and leaves. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about actors on the show, actors that we think do a good job. And I think this may sound mean-spirited, but I want to put a little framing around it, that if I'm saying Britt Lower is doing a good job, that means nothing if I don't call out when I think somebody else is not doing a good job, right? Mm-hmm. Or at least acknowledge when I feel like there could be improvement in the acting. And that's the second point I wanted to make with the Dylan storyline, is the character of Gretchen, the actress for Gretchen, Merritt Weaver, is playing that, and I think on purpose, flat, but it is not working for me. What do you think?
No, I'm with you. It worked at first, particularly when she was on the phone and she was talking to Dylan and she came across as kind of like flatly supportive. That kind of fit my imagining of the character and, you know, actually kind of worked emotionally for that scene. In the last couple episodes, it's been fine. This is the first one, though, of where a few of the scenes that she was in, particularly when she was having the conversation with any Dylan when she was back in the room. Out of Dylan's scene, it was still okay because Dylan was dominating the scene. But when she was with any Dylan, some of her line delivery just didn't work for me. It just felt noticeably like, well, that's a take choice right there. I'm not sure why they went with that one. So yeah
I just feel like I'm trying to find the right word, because it's somewhere on the spectrum between boring and unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And that's not a great place for you to be, right? When your acting's being described and it's not engaging with me as a viewer, but I also am not sure how realistic it is considering the situation she's now faced with. I agree with you. It was realistic when she was frustrated with her husband and just trying to like say whatever she has to do to get off the phone. Like that works. But now she's in this highly emotional, highly sort of volatile situation she's placed herself in, and it still seems very flat to me.
And it's one of the things I've talked to you before off pod, that there's been some times of where it took me a while to get used to Patricia Arquette's acting for Kobelvig, of where it came across as so unnatural that I was like, I don't know how to perceive this. It's kind of taking me out to a bit, but now I get the reasons for it. It's meant to be unnatural. It's meant to be stilted. She's born and raised in a community that can barely function as humans with anyone outside of their immediate circle. So I've come around to that. This felt not particularly natural, not particularly real, but there's not a real reason for it that we've been given so far for it to not have that kind of emotional resonance that so many of the rest of the characters do. Particularly when, you know, it's meant to be a very heartrending scene that she's being affected by too. So if there's a bit of a low mark in the episode, I would say that acting did not click for me very well.
Didn't work for me either. Obviously, the actress has been in a lot of really great stuff. She's been in Walking Dead, among other things. But that just has not worked for me. But I continue to think that Britt Lower's acting is a real bright spot for this show. And I would love to see it get acknowledged in one of these many variable award shows. And I don't know the relative, like, value of each of them, but like, I don't know what's the most important. Is it Ibby? Is it whatever the hell it is? But one that she might care about, I hope that she gets, because it's been fantastic.
Well, if you want to talk about acting greats, the fact that we got more scenes of Christopher Walken and John Turturro just together talking, gee, that's always going to make me happy, because good God, do those guys act every scene off.
Yeah, very good. What did you take of this? Because it, what? You know, we believed that Christopher Walken's character was a Severance, you know, disciple through and through, that it was absolutely in lockstep with Lumen and the powers that be. And that proved to be somewhat correct, but the genuine feelings for Bert also seemed to be real and valid. And he sticks Bert on a train, and there's this conversation where Bert's like, hey,
I'm ready.
Or Irving is like, Irving's like, hey, Bert, aren't you going to get in trouble for this? Like, they're going to be upset with you. And Bert's just kind of like, yeah, probably. But he still does it anyway. What do you take of this sort of cognitive dissonance here with the character?
I read the man wrong. I read the man incompletely. We were right to distrust. Yeah. We were right to distrust his background. We were right that he was lying. We were right that he was hiding things. What I inappropriately foreclosed was the ability of a person to want to change and how much that can affect their actions and affect how their character should ultimately be perceived. I feel like this plot line is, in a way I did not expect, but should have, in mirror in some ways to the Dale and Gretchen plot line, of where it's two characters dealing with relationships that are overlapping between Audi and Annie, deciding what choices they want to make with their lives. And we got to see how that could play out differently based on how differently they went about this kind of scene. And I thought it was sold and worked for me so much better than that other scene worked out, of where I'm a sucker for a redemption arc. I'm a sucker for a character that wants to turn over another leaf in a way that they know won't fix things, that they know won't undo the sins of the past, that they know may work out very poorly for them, but still consciously does so, knowing all that. And that's what we got to see out of Bert here. And I don't know where their plot line is going to end. I don't know whether Irving is gone for good, and also his lovely dog Radar. I can't tell you where this storyline is going to conclude. I was wrong in a lot of my assumptions when it comes to it, but it played out wonderfully in this episode. And I almost have no notes about it. I thought it was just very well handled in terms of why each character did what they did and how we got to see it on the screen.
How did you feel seeing a Spencer be pulled in live action, an actual Spencer occur in live action? And for those that don't know, a Spencer is when you have a romantic interest and you put him on a train and send him as far away as humanly possible. We call that a Spencer.
Okay, you haven't told me before that we called that a Spencer. I can see reasons for it in a way I hate you, and we're going to talk about that later, because I want to see the dictionary y'all are keeping on me now and frustrate myself endlessly at how accurate some of the terms are. But yes, I'd rather like
send him across the country.
He sent him out of Kyr. We don't know. It was literally cross-country or entering a different time zone. Let's just have that on the record. It was a scene that very well done, carried by two great actors. It kept me guessing even in the moments of it. Kept the character guessing. I mean, if I was Irv, I wouldn't have gotten in that car with Bert. I would have assumed he was going to kill me. I don't know what Bert had to say off camera to get Irving in that car, other than Irving was confident enough that if push came to shove, he could fight and defend himself, which he probably could from what we know about his background. It was very well handled, because it crystallized each of the scenes we had. It offered the more complete package of what we previously could only speculate about. If this is where their storyline ends, it's complete. It's well executed. We got all the parts. We got to fumble around having fun with how they would put together, and now we've seen how it was handled by the original puzzle masters, and it was a complete tale in a way that's hard to do.
Is there a chance that this is a double cross? Is there a chance
it's
that Luman wanted Irving far, far away from Cold Harbor, and this was a way to convince him to leave?
It is possible. I'll acknowledge that. The show's always going to leave open a possibility like that. I think it's even acknowledged in the characters' reactions that that could very well be possible in terms of how things is handled. We had Bert reading Irv's notes about people disappearing and whether they may have been murdered or what happened to them, whatever else. How are we to know that this isn't exactly what occurred previously and this is why people have disappeared or left or whatever else? We don't know. All we are left to interpret is the evidence that we got. And from an emotional standpoint, it doesn't have to be that case, but I like that they even still left that possibility for how we could be left to interpret this thing.
I kind of think that's what it was. I'm about 55-45 that's what it was. It was getting Bert or Irving far away from the situation, and Irving is just another drone. I feel like that's the most logical, considering what we know about Bert's past. It would make for the best
contrast. What do we know about Bert's past?
Well, that he's worked for Luman, and that he's been he has been such a loyal Luman disciple that, or at least we've heard this, that he has looked for some redemption through mm-hmm. the severance process, because he's not necessarily proud of all the things he's done in his career. It would also give a really great contrast with Bert's Innie, who was very much a rebel and pushed back against the Luman apparatus. So I feel like that's probably the most likely there, but I don't know for sure. I do know the dog rules, and Radar's the best. Great. And a very bold move by the show to have a dog that age on screen, because mm-hmm. you just don't know with a dog that age if they'll make it to the season four.
Possibilities, again, that the character may have actually exited the show in some shape or form, because the dog may not be around in 3 years' time when we want to see them again. If I had to do percentages for me, I'm 75-25 in favor of that. Bert's actually being honest about his motivations and what he's doing. I'm very much still leaving open, you know, a fourth option that there is a double bluff at play here, but I'm leaning in favor of, this helps me interpret and process some of the things I saw in that dinner scene.
All right, let's move on to Mark and his fabulous sister.
This is, again, just notes for me. The fact that I took the time to make little hearts next to Devin's name in my notes says a lot about how I'm responding to the character.
I think I'm in love with her.
She's great. And a lot of her assumptions, her determination appears to be paying off, of where I still wouldn't trust Kobeldic. She has her own motives. You don't fully understand those. She's still playing close to the vest about what information she has and what information she's willing to reveal. But she's useful. She has access. She has knowledge. She is a person you want to be on your side, even if at the end of things you have to assume that, even if they don't necessarily betray you, they are going to do their own objectives that are not necessarily in line with yours.
Yeah, I mean, when I say I think I'm in love with her, I think that probably, especially like people listening to this and hearing like two male voices are like, oh God. I don't necessarily mean romantically. Like, one of the things that I had, one thought I had in watching her in this episode and steer Mark and help Mark, is I had this like sort of sibling envy. Like, man, wouldn't it be so great to have a sister like this? Because she's like, so patient with Mark, who's completely unreasonable, and is guiding him and doing everything she possibly can to keep him safe, but also progress his interest in getting his wife back. I felt like she's just a really well-written character and extremely well-acted. All around a joy to watch on the screen.
As you may have noticed from people I like to hang around or have crushed on or have been with for more than a few years, I like to be around people that will duel with me. At wits or otherwise, will consistently challenge me or push me or play with me. That is what Dylan do when it comes to her relationship with Mark, and it's just a delight to see it on the screen. Every line the two of them offer just feels so real and so delightful in terms of, oh, we're watching a relationship that's been 35, 40 years, however else all these characters are in the making, and it's portrayed quite accurately on the screen. I mean, her opening line of the episode is something like, sorry, the wind was whistling over the hole in your back of your skull, so I didn't quite get that. And it doesn't stop from there. Every one of their lines is an active duel that has been decades in the making.
See, it's interesting how what we like about a character says about who we are and our preferences, because that's what you, that's why you are going at this, like, man, I really like this character. For me, I'm going at it like, and you know this about me, I really value loyalty in people. It's like a huge thing for me is loyalty. And she displays a level of loyalty for Mark. I mean, like, it's easy in media for us to display brothers and sisters as if they'll go to the wall for each other. But that is not how that normally, not I wouldn't say normally, but that is not how it always works in life. Mm-hmm. Very often, brothers and sisters are not willing to just drop everything in their life and go help their brother or sister for a week, 2 weeks, whatever, put themselves in physical danger, you know, buck back against a, you know, authoritarian system to try to help you in some way. Not every sibling relationship is like that. And I just really admired the loyalty she shows for him. Of course, it speaks to a broader backstory of their relationship and how close they are.
Certainly.
But also makes her somebody in the show I'm rooting for.
It meant that 100% agree with you there. It is among the relationships that I have thought at times were ride or die when it came to the show. I've never had any doubts about, and I've been reaffirmed in my belief of, that the ultimate true, loyal, dedicated relationship in this show is Mark and his sister Deb.
Yep.
There is, if the show ever messes with that or tries to pull back on that, it's going to hurt my overall appreciation of the show, because they've done that so well. They've made me so committed and believing in that relationship that if it did something to show that there is an unearned amount of distrust or not dedication to each other, I wouldn't buy it, because they've done it so well up to this point.
I agree. That's not one to play with our expectations, because it's the foundation is important to the show. So you don't want to shake that foundation, right? Like, I mean, playing with expectations is good, but not when it upends your understanding of the show and a broad appeal for the show. And I think more, I mean, I intake some Severance coverage, like other pods, other YouTube channels that cover it, and universally the relationship between Devin and Mark is appreciated on the show and trusted, like you just communicated. So yeah, really like that. Really, as I mentioned in the intro, really excited to see where the Kobelvig conversation goes.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I don't have a ton of thoughts. I could theorize as to what it's going to be, but I think it's been, well, particularly that plot line of Mark, Devin, and then pulling in Kobelvig has been well paced for me.
It has been, and it raises interesting questions about what was Rigabi's plans versus what were Kobel's plans, because they can't be the same. It seems like they have fundamentally different means of how they're going to go about their objectives. Rigabi's plans seem to be, okay, if I can break Severance and get, you know, some degree of reintegration happen, then Mark can go down to the floor and then do shit. That seemed to be my kind of impression about what her plan was to get a person that can be a spy on the floor and be able to move between floors without changing over much. That seemed to be what her goal is. Seems to be Kovel thinks that's just a murder waiting to happen. But I don't know what information that they can convey or get on the Mark right now that's going to be useful for their purposes, other than the fact that I don't know whether they're going to do like that dumb aspect of Minority Report of where for some reason they just didn't cancel Kobel's access codes, which I love the movement hour report, but I always thought that was stupid. And I hope they don't go that route when it comes to this thing, that's how they're going to go about this, is that she can just still waltz onto the floor. I hoping that's not going to be that, but I don't really know the answer otherwise about what information they look to get out of Mark to in some way make it possible that if they're going to take him back to the severed floor this season, which I assume they're going to next episode based on promises made to Milkchick, what's going to be the purpose of that or how they're going to go about it? I don't know, but I think it's well set up that there's going to be an answer to that question, and I'm going to like it.
So Rigabi makes me like IRBs.
Go on.
Yeah. So in science, right, when scientists are going to engage in a study that includes living subjects in some way, some sort of subject, living subjects, it could be animals, humans, whatever. They, when they're engaging in science with and doing a study with living subjects, they need to, within their institution, go to a separate body called the Institutional Review Board, IRB, submit the methodology, the study design to them. The IRB will approve or not approve. They'll have notes, they'll change it, whatever, and give it back to them, because scientists in their zeal for knowledge have shown through history that they can be a bit morally gray in chasing new information and can lose sight of they can lose sight of morality and ethics in their chase and quest for knowledge. And that is exactly what I view Raghavi as. I think Raghavi is so, I told you she was, I think she's the counter to Lumen. She's the revolutionary, and her way of pushing back on Lumen is to corrupt and destroy the technology, the Severance technology. I don't think she knows what she's doing, but I also don't think she's thinking ethically about the harm to Mark, Petey, whoever she's working with. She's thinking about the ultimate goal of harming Lumen. So when I watch Raghavi, I go, you know what? It's great that we have IRBs. Did I connect the dots for you?
You did. You pieced that together very well. Well handled. It's interesting if we paint Raghavi as the revolutionary. Most revolutions are successful in some shape or form because someone from the in-group participates in terms of making the revolt happen or providing resources or access or knowledge or some way along those lines. She is one of those people, but she seems to have eliminated in her mind the possibility that Kobel could be too, or at least be used in some shape or form in that manner. Because even the concept of trying to reach out to talk to Kobel leads her to just abandon all of the resources she's committed to this and exit stage left in a way. Yep. I don't know if we're going to see her again.
I think Kobel's reaction as the sort of a OG of the Severance technology to Raghavi and how Raghavi is operating. Raghavi's like you said, absolute, like magnetic, polar, like I got to get away, like cannot be in the same area as Kobel. I don't want to be around. Speaks to me that they're like, she's worried about accountability with what she's been doing with Mark. Mark also hasn't had great physical reactions to what she's been doing. So I think she's just flailing in the wind. I think she doesn't know what she's doing, but she's chasing a way to undermine the technology and harm Lumen. And she doesn't really care if Mark gets hurt in the process.
I also get kind of the vibe that the two of them may have gone to the same. I haven't looked up the age of the actresses, nor do I know what age the show is trying to portray in terms of whether they are meant to be different generations or some shape or form or not. But the impression I increasingly have is that the two knew each other in school in some shape or form and may even come up with each other to a certain degree. Whereas previously, I thought they didn't even know each other.
Yeah, I don't know. And I think if there is that backstory there, we'll likely get it in this conversation because I'm sure there'll be a discussion about what Mark was doing with Raghavi and any sort of thoughts that Kobelvik has about Raghavi, I hope are given to us there.
Two more things when it comes to the whole Mark, Devon, and Kobelvik. One, I'm glad I got the sentence, as I often like to talk about, of I got Mark expressing some doubt or frustration or resistance to the idea of working with Devon. I needed that. It was hanging out.
Wasn't that one of the first substantial thing he says where he's like, we told her everything, she gave a shit.
Yeah, that level of resistance. And then him opening the conversation with, you know, hey, Mark, how are you? He's like, oh, my God, so good. My wife's being held prisoner at Lumen, and I just got brain surgery in a basement. How have you been? Thank you. Realistic. Appreciated that. Was wondering why no one was bringing this up. Glad they have. I could buy Devon because she's dedicated to Mark and is willing to take chances and risks to protect Mark in the way that she can have better understanding and control of. Mark, just going into this, like you said, maybe for 5 minutes of Devon browbeating him, then he's going to start being sarcastic Mark again at a minimum. We also reference this to a certain degree, the name of the episode and some references we get later when Kobel is driving Devon and Mark to the birthing retreat or whatever this place is called. I forget the actual term.
I think it's birthing retreat. I think that's what it is.
Is for reasons I'm waiting to have explained is more than just being an in-joke because the writers like the Twilight Zone. It's a lock, stock, and barrel reference, the title to the After Hours episode of the 1960 season of the Twilight Zone, which I did know the episode. I had to look back up the references they were made to remember that it was making this episode, but Marcia White, Ninth Floor, Golden Thimble, it's all that classic episode of the Twilight Zone, which as we referenced, we were getting into things you were quite familiar with yourself.
Yeah. It's called the Birthing Cabin.
Birthing Cabin. Thank you.
All right. And then we can, before we move on to another plot line, let's talk about showing up at the birthing cabin and particularly the line, I don't have anything scheduled. She's one of James. No one's to know. Miss Marcia White, Ninth Floor Specialties Department.
Yeah, which is all referencing the idea that, you know, the episode's about... am I allowed to spoil an episode of a classic television show that's now 65 years old? Is that allowed?
That goes through IRB. Sails right through.
Okay, just... For all of our listeners, if you haven't actually seen The Twilight Zone, you can. It's a great show. There are some truly classic episodes, and you can see how influential it has been. It's old as shit, very black and white, but...
It's wonderful. I watch it all the time. I watch Twilight Zone all the time.
The quality of writing is absent from this day and age. It's that well written when it comes to some of the, particularly the classic episodes. Rod Serling, for the win. But the episode is, the overarching plot is, it's about a department store, a woman... wandering through the store, things getting increasingly weird and seemingly cut off from reality for it to be revealed that eventually she is a mannequin dummy that has become animated and gone beyond the time that the mannequin dummies allow one to roam about in the real world. As she's realizing the ninth floor is actually just a storage space where the mannequins are kept, the golden thimble that she pursues is just a meaningless token and icon. It's a heck of a reveal and a well-done build of the episode. The fact that they're making those references, talking about... she's one of James, paints a nightmarish picture about how the various women that Jane Egan has used and abused and gotten pregnant in the past have been treated, and how this birthing retreat has been used in that regard. It also raises fascinating questions about the fact that we've never met Helena's mother and probably never will.
I also felt like there were some... like cinematography references to Twilight Zone throughout, the final shot with Kubelvig there with the flames in the back, the music that hits. And I think that they've used some Twilight Zone where Twilight Zone has been instrumental in pushing a particular style of cinematography. So I'm thinking particularly about, I know Twilight Zone did not invent this, but they were sort of known for it and mainstreamed it a little bit. The using a very limited color palette and stark.
White, so yeah.
Well, yeah, but they would pop. They would pop use pops of something really dark or really light.
Yes.
And the show routinely will have very limited colors so that something will pop. Mm-hmm. You know, also the shots of hallways, of course, is a huge one. And silhouetting people with door frames and window sills and walls, you know, all of those things that we saw so much in The Twilight Zone, ever present in the show. So not surprised that they would do a bit of an homage there with the name of the episode.
I mean, Twilight Zone is so much. I don't even know if it's fair to say The Twilight Zone is an inspiration for the show. The Twilight Zone is influential enough; it's an inspiration for everything in this entire genre and beyond its genre when it comes to how much, you know, it still has legs in our modern cinematographer world, in our modern world of media. But that episode in particular, I had never really thought about because I hadn't even watched that episode in a decade or longer, probably even longer than that. Yeah, that episode's on point when it comes to this show in general. They may just be making a whole plot reference to, hey, that's classic episode of The Twilight Zone. We drew inspiration when we thought up this entire damn thing in the first place.
I think the reveal, though, that Jane Egan is knocking up Lumen employees will have consequences later on. I mean, I think you've got these multiple...
They know about it.
These multiple... Yeah, well, it does demonstrate the level that Kubelvig was connected into what's going on in the company. That's important because she's even able to pull out a name that is somewhat realistic that Jane Egan might have gotten this woman pregnant. But there's also, you know, the swim lanes of like, what does this mean? Is he just like a sort of more straightforward, just abuser of power and privilege to get what he wants? Or is this more of like into like the eugenics breeding angle that we see with the goats being referenced and the constant discussions about what the technology is for in the show?
I'm worried also to a certain degree it's going to tie into the Wintertide Fellowship and the fact that, you know, he makes sure to give each of these young girls his head. I don't know whether that's an overly on-point reference to an unfortunate thing, but it raises raises questions if we're tying into an L. Ron Hubbard kind of connection here as well, or a lot of cult leaders of where they emphasized with Cobell that he took a personal interest in you and you were carrying on his message and his purpose, and the fact that she knows so much about his girls, I wonder and have questions, particularly given the personal sense of betrayal she seems to feel at Jane Egan.
Well, I mean, I think that like the first swim lane of that, that he would be using his sort of power as a religious head, a business head, a governmental head to abuse women is not great, but not shocking. That is that it, that would almost be, it would be much more realistic, but less
interesting.
Don't say expected. No, much more realistic, but less interesting. I think,
yes.
If there was some sort of connection to the overall purpose of Lumen and the technology, that would engage me a bit more, just because the first swim lane, as we've seen it a million times, it, men do it. It sucks. But it's a serious hype archetype, and prevalent everywhere. The second one would be interesting to get more information about, like, this guy, what he's trying to do with Lumen and the connection to it. But I don't think we know yet. One thing though, you mentioned the internship, Miss Wong.
Yeah, what's behind that?
There's something that this show is doing this season that I find really interesting. And that is they're taking all of the people that I thought, the Lumen employees, the W-2s, the actual employees of Lumen, not the owners, the employees of Lumen.
Rank and file.
They're taking all of them that I thought were evil in the last season and showing me that they probably aren't, that they're caught up in an evil corporation, but they have sympathies. They can be sympathetic as well. You know, Kobelvig, obviously we've seen her in a sympathetic light. Milchick, my boy, justice for Milchick. And then Miss Wong, who now is very much into sort of like in the trust bubble for me. Like when I'm seeing her having to break her puzzle, I'm like, let's get her a t-shirt. Let's get justice for Miss Wong a t-shirt. Yeah. Let's get that on a t-shirt too, because I felt like, okay, maybe she's just participating in this internship in a desire to move ahead, but is also being abused and mistreated within the system. And I certainly didn't feel good when she was getting on the short bus at the end.
It feels like the show's making an overall comment about the similarities when it comes to the rank and file women employees and the people on the severed floor, that they are humans that haven't been allowed to human because of where they've been confined in their lives. That Milchick, Swong in particular, they're people that we can see maybe in a different environment, maybe in a different background, maybe different opportunities. They would be just fun people to hang out with, normal Joes. But because they've been raised in Lumen, they've had any form of choice removed from them, they've had any alternative perspectives cut away, and we're seeing what the results of that are in a way that is ultimately tragic. That these are, they're not allowed to be dyed-in-the-wool villains because they haven't been given enough choice to make it that such. They haven't had a sense of agency to make them evil in a way that otherwise the leadership of Lumen clearly are. And for Miss Wong in particular, it was just sad this episode. The one thing that, I mean, we have seen increasingly, the few things that she's able to find joy in are rapidly taken away from her callously. That, you know, she clearly looked forward to the idea of marshmallows and making that fire. Taken away just casually by Milchick to punish other people. That she clearly enjoys working on her instrument. Removed, again, casually, because it would like to send a message and it would be otherwise inappropriate. That she, one of the few things that's hers that she likes to enjoy is this little ring game, and is now, by Milchick, seemingly as an act of just punishment on her, petty punishment, is forced to crush it there before then, and I'm going to ask you about this, I assumed that her posting came as a surprise. Not just that her fellowship is ending early, but where she is being sent, it sounded like a punishment. It sounded like a slight. It sounded like, you know, Milchick gave her a bad review, and now she's being sent to a remote archipelago that's in the Arctic Circle, far north of, it's closer to the friggin' North Pole than it is to Norway, which has like 2,000 people, and I only know about because the friggin' seed vault is there. And Lumen, if you're messing with the seed vault, I will never forgive you. It felt like that came as quite a shock, and it was like, oh shit, I'm sorry I offended you. Why did you do my review in such a way that I got sent there rather than somewhere else? And it...
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I find it interesting that they still trust Milchick's reviews to actually take corporate action based on his review, but they are a very hierarchical organization, so as long as he's still in that role, maybe that's the explanation there.
I feel like...
Go ahead.
It felt personal, and it seemed like it hurt her too, that he framed it as, you will now be leaving your housing with your family and now being sent to Svalbard. Of where it was like, we had originally imagined this girl was like severed and only lived in the severed world. No, she's got a family. She's got some connection, some comfort, and now even that's being taken away from her. She's losing her last item. She's not bringing her theremin. She's not bringing her marshmallows. She's being ripped away from her family and sent to the most remote locations of possible remote locations, where her life will be even more fully controlled and encapsulated by Lumen, because there'd be nothing else there.
Why did she... her first reaction was, I thought I could stay through the quarter. Why did she say that? Why does she want to stay through the quarter?
I think there's some measure of freedom, some measure of agency that she's got with having a task on the severed floor, that she's given some measure of authority. She's given some measure of control that she otherwise lacks. She may be enjoying this. I mean, when she apologized to Dylan, it felt very sincere. Like, she's actually been trying to do a good job as, what was it, a facilitator or something like that? Was that how she expressed it?
Uh-huh.
That she seems like she's really liked making the fires, that she's really liked arranging for all these activities. She's clearly taken pride in it. She clearly actually wants to be doing a good job and is invested in it. And so the fact that that's being taken away from her, that doesn't just smart. There's not just pride at play there. I'm emphasizing that aspect. There's also an aspect of, maybe this is a girl that's gotten to live for the first time in her life in all kinds of exciting ways, and now she's seeing that door close as she's sent to the ass end of the Arctic world.
That's interesting. Yeah, this idea that this was freeing and she enjoyed the posting on the severed floor. I took it as yet another, like, addition to N, right? It's that we're increasing the sample size of people, Lumen employees, who work on the severed floor, who develop affection for the innies, for the severed employees, because she clearly is affected by what Dylan is doing and feels a measure of guilt. She doesn't want to leave the severed floor. We've seen it now with Cobell developing a kinship with them and a concern for their well-being. I think Milchick has it as well, that he's trying to hide. So it's like, you know, now we're three of three with employees that have to work with them on the daily, you know, caring about their future and their self-interest or their interest.
It's notable too that Dylan, as rough as he's being to everybody else, took the time to say it's not your fault to her as well. That he seemed like he recognized that there is an innocent person who is being honest right now, and that should be appreciated, even in the most stark state of depression that he's presently in.
Can you stop by the break room on the way out, Dylan, and apologize to Helly E? My gosh.
One thing I wanted to reference there before I forgot. I don't know if I'd actually put two and two together, because I hadn't seen it fully, or maybe I'd looked away. That the hang in there poster is fucking Dylan doing the Pillars of Hercules right there.
Yeah.
I felt incredibly symbolic that Dylan is the image of hang in there, and it's Helly that has to pick up the hidden note behind it and carry it on. Because Dylan is the past, apparently, and Helly's the one that's going to have to carry Irv's message into the future.
And that image is so powerful because it's like what I view Dylan as. He's the one holding it all together.
Yeah.
And he readily gives up that position this episode in a really dramatic way. It was strange for me. Two more pieces on the plot before we go to our segments. I do want to talk about the best scene of the episode.
I hope
absolutely.
I'm gonna agree.
Absolutely.
Tell me.
The best scene of the episode.
John.
When our guy, Mr. Milchick. Devour feculence. What a line.
I love that scene. It was such a great line. I love, again, I want Milchick. I want good things for Milchick. I didn't ever think I would say those words going into this season, but I really do. And seeing him speak both with his own voice and then purposefully speak down to Drummond in the way that Drummond's demanded of him to, again, basically tell him to go to hell, was just great. I mean, it may not be the most meaningful line of the episode in terms of the overall plot, but in terms of my scenes of the episode and best lines of dialogue, him telling him to devour feculence and then ending with, do you mind if I read the whole line? Because it's just such a great series of lines.
Go right ahead, sir.
I mean, the back and forth is great. If we're Drummond, basically he's trying, don't you love when someone makes you apologize and then makes you apologize in the way they want? That kind of power trip. I've had that happen to me before, and you can picture how roughly that rubbed me.
You don't have to air all of our grievances here on the podcast. You don't have to say everything I've done to you as a podcast co-host.
No, uniquely, this is not a moment where I'm indirectly saying fuck you. Most of the time it is. This one's not directed at you.
Indirectly saying devour feculence?
No. No, I'm actually remarkably more coarse than that. No, but again, tells him to devour feculence, goes through the whole, before then goes through the whole apologize, it's all your fault, which was interesting to have, you know, him tell Milchick it's all your fault when it took Dylan to say back to Miss Wong, it isn't your fault. That felt like, again, Lumen as a company exists to punch down that everyone does that because everyone's being abused, and so they're all taking it out on somebody else. It's just how they handle things.
Truth.
But Drummond says this, Milchick responds to devour feculence, and then he says, it means eat shit, Mr. Drummond. What did you say to me? I'm the manager of the severed floor, which means two things. First, I am owed a measure of respect, even by my superiors. You go, you. Yes, speak that truth. Then going into second, and more obvious, that said floor comprises the whole of my jurisdiction. To put that monosyllabically, love you parsed each of those out, it is not my fault what Mark Scout does when he is not at work. It's yours. I stood and applauded. I paused the episode. It was so great.
It was a fantastic scene. you know, I think that the two things is that Milchick has been written sympathetic enough we can cheer when he's doing this in the same episode that he's abusing Miss Wong.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think a component of that is that it's sold through the charismatic acting of the actor, right? The actor acts this with such obvious charisma and engagement. Like I want to see him on screen doing more things every time I see him, that I think he carries that what should be some dissonance there for the viewer.
Yeah. In a show of where 99% of the actors are just utter top of the game and killing their roles, Milchick still is at least top three, if not leading the pack in terms of just how well that actor is portraying that character on screen and how well the character is written too. Let's round the package in terms of how this is coming about. I think it also sets up what's a great scene that follows of where
Tremell Tillman is the person's name.
Tremell Tillman.
I should say the names when we talk about the actors. Tremell Tillman.
Thank you. I need to look up what else he's been in, because this is the first thing I've really distinctly recognized him in, but I feel like I may have seen him in other roles.
I'll tell you in a second, but I will say this. He had one of the best appearances on the Colbert Show that I've seen in years. I mean, he was so good on the Colbert Show. Yeah, he was otherworldly. He was really, really funny and engaging. He did a really funny bit, like filmed a little short. So yeah, really good. He has not been in a whole heck of a lot. He has been in Hunters, a detective series, Godfather of Harlem. He's been in the movie Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning, which is in post-production, is not out yet. Mm-hmm. So yeah, not really been in a lot.
Okay. Man, knocking it out of the park in his first big show in his first biggest, moment in the show. It's set up also just such a great scene that followed, of where we get that wonderful confrontation. It comes out of the scene of him abusing Huang, so we're getting, again, the complete package of the character that we struggle with, of where it's a sympathetic villain. And I think it's fair to call him a villain, that he isn't a villainous kind of role in terms of what his overall effect is in the plot, at least at present. Of where Mark then, at the prompting of Kobelvig, calls him to explain why he's not at work, the thing that Milchick was getting browbeat by Drummond for in the first place. And Mark is told to lie and say, I'm sick. And Mark chooses not to do that, and instead says, I'm not sick. I just need the day, okay? And Milchick, almost seemingly earnestly or curiously, asks, may I ask why? Almost to like a degree of, it's a foreign enough concept for him to have someone be able to or want to or conceptualize the idea of needing a personal day and asking for it. Because maybe that's something he's never been allowed the opportunity of.
And being honest in that conversation. Like, I don't think he's not used to dealing with somebody just hitting him with that sort of personal honesty.
Yeah. And Mark says, no, I've got life stuff. Isn't that what Lumen's all about? Balance? I mean, work is just work, right? And if there's ever been a line on this show, that one apparently, visibly, rocks Milchick to his core, of where he stares off at what is, it's like a photo of an iceberg on a wall or something like that that he's looking at.
I suspect it's an image meant to capture the town we saw last episode.
A reference to a salt stack. Very, very possible, yes. But I'm left to wonder in this scene, this is a guy that almost like just had his moment of finding Rickon's book of horrors. Like, that is such a foreign concept to him. The idea of work-life balance, the idea that there could be a life outside of Lumen, the idea that there could be opportunities or things that you need to complete yourself that Lumen can't provide, because he's never been allowed to think that before. He's never been given that opportunity. That it seems like it almost brings him to tears to ponder that, to think about that, to imagine a world where that would be possible. And that is fucking perfect in terms of a moment to, you know, further drive the character towards the conclusion we hope for him, of where that kind of statement from Audi, it's an Audi statement. He's on the severed floor when he gets this. It's something that is thrown in that he wasn't meant to get, to someone to offer that perspective. And it's a perspective that's true, but it's also hiding something. But he interprets it as being 100% true, 100% legitimate, 100% foreign in a way that emotionally affects him. And that was really well handled and will be really interesting to see for this character who has been forced, as we've seen at every moment, to be just on call 24/7, to make Lumen his life, to have no opportunities outside of what Lumen chooses to provide him, like crumbs at the table. What that kind of different perspective on reality is going to have going forward. Because from how the character reacts and responds, that's another thing that's going to have legs.
When you heard that line, work is just work, right? Did you get short of breath? Did you break out in hives? Did you throw your remote at the television? What was the physical reaction?
Okay. Lee is right now doing what's called emphasizing the personal nature of what the hell I just said to want to present to the audience maybe why this line is resonating with me so much. I'll just summarize and say, I reacted a bit like Milchick did and leave it the fuck at that.
That is what I was doing. Man, well said. Last plot line we should talk about, I feel really good about it, is the ending scene with Helly E and Jaime Egan.
What do we make of that? What was that? Why is he there? What is he
saying? This is what I want to say. You tricked me. What does this mean, Spencer?
I he has to know that it. Oh, okay. All right, if you want to read this on the surface, maybe he's just literally referencing the finale of season one, of where she did, Helly did interact with him and convince him briefly that she was his daughter. Is he just referencing that?
So did he go down there that reading, which I agree is the most like sort of easy to digest surface reading, is he went down there specifically to talk to Helly, the innie,
by himself,
to confront her about what she did in the finale of season one.
Yes. And seemingly only because she stayed late. Based on the fact the lights were off, Dylan had already left, are we led to believe that she in some way stayed past her exit call? Or is she just...
Yeah, she's down there. I thought she was trying to memorize so she could get rid of the evidence, right? If she could memorize it, then she could get rid of it. I kind of assume that was what she was doing.
No, I agree. I think that's why she has done that, so that she could either do it today or do it later. She's disposing of the evidence and burning it into her memory, like Mark trying to, you know, preserve the knowledge on the eyeballs kind of thing. But the fact the lights were off, it's either an indication that she's so focused on this task she just hasn't friggin' moved enough that this is one of the annoying rooms that has motion control lights, because totally Lumen would have the motion control lights that turn off if you don't move enough, like every annoying office in the world. Or it's because she stayed past her time, which is how I originally interpreted the scene. And is there past authorized hours. Hence, maybe why Jaime Egan felt he could easily then go down there alone to talk with her. Why he's choosing to confront her? Why he's there alone, presumably alone? What the overall purpose is behind this? It ain't going to be good, because this is very much in the category of characters of where if the average Lumini is only vaguely human on their best of their days, this person isn't even trying to maintain their skid suit lizard person that they are. This guy's never felt like anything other than an animatronic that got loose from the wax hall.
He does have a very robotic way about him. I feel like it's probably, he's probably confronting her about the events of the end of season one. And I think it's a pretty great parallel with the conversation that Helly had with Dylan, where Dylan was like, hey, Mark couldn't tell that you were Helena down here. And now her dad is saying, I couldn't tell that Helena was Helly when you were flipped. But I think the prospect of Helly talking to Jamie Egan is really exciting. And I'm glad they ended that where they did. That all she said is, what the fuck? And you didn't get the full conversation there.
We don't need to. They've set it up beautifully. We've got this. We have the screen notes. We've got the stage directions. We're ready to go. And don't do that episode 10. Do that episode 9, because it sets up a great episode 10. Taking notes, House of the Dragon, just, you know, keep this in mind for next season.
Fantastic. All right. Well, that's all the plot points I wanted to talk about.
Well, just a bet for you when it comes to this last scene. What do you think it's more likely, that the emotional feeling of the outie passes into the innie and she's somewhat chastened and demure when it comes to this scene, or does she go full innie Helly and throw something at him before the scene's over?
I think it is. If I'm writing this character, honestly, I think it's absolutely on the table. She tries to kill him if she figures out who he is.
In character?
He's taking an incredible risk by putting himself in any sort of physical proximity with Helly. I mean, Helly is a live wire and really, really hates this entire apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a chance that she does something like that. More likely, though, is that it takes her a while to figure out who the hell it is. And she does give whoever it is a piece of her mind. I think that that's more likely than like a physical interaction.
What's also the possibility that she does attack him and we find out that he is some kind of animatronic from the, what's it called? What hall is it? You know, where they come from, where you got to see
In season one, the hall of whatever, hall of the founders or whatever it was. Yeah. Wouldn't it be interesting if she's just choking him and he's just not dying? He's just like, hey, she can choke me all day long. I'm going to be fine. I am a lizard person.
I would think that in terms of possibilities, I'm betting that is more likely than not, plus some reveal from that of what the board actually is before this season's over.
You want to do some segments?
Oh, let's do some segments, sir.
Let's do it.
Who is your employee of the week when it comes to this severed floor or otherwise?
Helly. Absolutely. It's Helly.
Helly's the only one working.
She's down there. She's continuing to try to figure out what Irvin was passing along. She's eyes on the prize. She's still trying to advance the interest of the Macrodata Rooftop Refinement team. She's not sold her team out. She deals with our guy, Dylan, being completely awful to her in a really sort of gracious way. I mean, I almost feel like that's growth from the character. I feel like in season one, she would have just taken her shoe off and hit him in the face. And instead she sort of eats that in the moment, knowing that he's in pain. And, you know, she's continuing to sort of advance those interests. And then the bucking of Milchick too. Mm-hmm. When she tells Milchick, like, don't you mean Helly E, which is how I'm referring to her from now on. And basically testing, like, now that she knows, it's really dangerous for Milchick that she knows that, like, she's an Egan.
What can you actually do?
Exactly. She's testing that. What can you do to me? Let's figure that out together. I thought it was Helly. Who do you award it to?
It can only be Helly. I mean, it's obviously Helly. I mean, so you'll see if that holds into the next episode. But as you said, she's working on Dylan. She's trying to advance the plot. She's carrying on Irving's message. She's also checking on Mark. Like, nobody else is doing that. She's taking the effort to go browbeat. I keep on using that word, but it feels accurate for how a lot of characters are treating each other this episode. Find out if Mark's alive and whether he's coming back. Say, Helly is the all-star of this episode. An episode that has a lot of cheer moments. Shall we go into some recommended lines of the episode, Seth?
Yeah, let's do lines of the episode.
Just a couple that just, you know, in terms of the relationship between Devon and Mark in a way that I adore. Sorry, the wind whistling over the hole in the back of your skull. I didn't quite get that. And then Mark also responding, tragically, you're you, was just a wonderful way of saying, who are you talking to right now?
Yeah, they still give us, it's because the relationship with Mark and Devon is something really beautiful, but they take great pains for it not to be saccharine.
Yes.
And I appreciate that too.
No, it has a delightful amount of salt to make it all that more real. Question for you. When you sleep in a car, do you sleep like Mark does with the seatbelt kind of used as a support while you're laying down?
Yeah.
Do you,
so like,
do you lean
when
back
I sleep
or lean
in a
forward?
car, this is a great question. When I sleep in a car, it's the same thing I do when I try to sleep on an airplane, and it's probably really bad for me, but all I do is just sort of, let my head drop forward and I arch my back and I just sort of sleep sitting up with my head, sort of crouched down and my back crouched. It's wonderful for my posture.
Like a puppet with your strings cut. That's how you make it through your flight or your car ride.
That's the only way. Cause I have a moral issue with reclining my seat on a plane. I will never do that.
Never.
And then I can't get comfortable any type of way in a car. What Mark is doing, the bouncing of the window on my head, I just can't do it, Spencer.
You've often accurately labeled me out for the jerk that I am, but there are limits of what a person can do. And one of those bastards that recline their seats on a plane are violating every rule of social decorum known to man, in my view.
You can't do it. I'm just not going to be one of those people. If you do it to me, I don't hate you forever, but like, I'm just not going to participate.
Nope.
I'm not doing it.
I will not add to that sin in the world. Continuing lines, again, the line from Dylan back to Gretchen. I'm going to go work and earn our paycheck to feed our children. And while I'm gone, I'm going to respect the request that you don't follow me and use my own body to fucking cheat on me.
What
well
a line.
Said, Dylan. Well said. Also from any Dylan, and he's got some haymakers this episode. You know, it's your fault that we're all down here, right? No, it's not. And if we're so different from our outies, then how come we couldn't tell when you were gone? Irving could. Mark couldn't. Sorry, because I'm an asshole down here.
The crowd goes wild.
Yeah, Dylan with his hopefully brief heel phase. You think there's any odds that Dylan's actually left the show? Like low, right?
Oh yeah, it's real low because I think for whatever reason, Milchick thought it was a good idea to let any Dylan think it's his choice. It is not his choice.
Yeah.
It's demonstrably proven between Helly and Mark that it is not the any's choice when they stay or go. So if Audi Dylan still wants to get the paycheck, which we have now plot and foundation for why he would insist on continuing that job, he'll just be back in the elevator next episode.
It's also even assuming that Audi Dylan has much of a choice when they basically deemed it necessary to have all of them to get Mark Scout to finish Cold Harbor. So there's a lot of reasons why any Dylan's request is not going to be fully processed.
Agreed.
Continuing on from Cobell and Mark back to each other. Hello, Mark. How are you? Oh, my God. So good. My wife's being held prisoner at Lumen, and I just got brain surgery in my basement. How have you been? We're allies now. There's no need to. Oh, we're allies now? We're not neighbors anymore. Sorry, I guess I got confused. Thank you. Wonderful. I wasn't expecting the sentence to be a sentence, but it was executed perfectly, and I got many rounds of that before the episode was done.
Nice contrast there between Spencer and myself, where Spencer's having a bad day. You say, "Hey, Spencer, how you doing?" "Ah, fine." Like, you know, he's not, he just, I'm having a bad day. Hey, Lee, how you doing? Man, you know, it hasn't really been that great. How long you got? I will sit and chat your ear off. Mark goes right into, I know that was just a sort of, you know, social norm, a welcoming sort of phrase of just starting the conversation. But let me dump on you all of the things I'm thinking right now.
There's an old Southern expression of the definition of a bore is you ask someone how they are and they tell you. It's like Southern expression is I'm fine. How you doing?
I'm the worst. So boring.
Let's continuing on. This is the back and forth between, I won't repeat it because I repeat it pretty much, you know, word for word as is, but Drummond Milchick back and forth.
Devour feculence.
All-star, great, stellar, wonderful, cheerworthy. Just great scene. The back and forth between Mark and Milchick, talking on the phone. Already read it word for word, won't do it again. Another great scene, very well executed. Emotionally very well handed between the respective characters. And then one of the closing ones from me is from Bert and Irving. I feel like I'm referencing the Sesame Street here at a certain point. You asked me why I severed. I like the idea that I could be innocent again, part of me. But then my innocent part fell in love with you. It could all be cover. It could all be subterfuge. It could all be mislead and misdirection. But if it isn't, and even if it is, it was emotionally very effective and well done line.
I will say that having Christopher Walken and John Turturro as those two characters, I'm sure that they didn't plan this way, but that is helpful because that's the one major plot point that I'm probably the least naturally interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fact that like Bert and Irving are like in love and like, and it's like seemingly very, very intense for how limited the interactions of both the innies and the outies have been is something I would roll my eyes at if they didn't find other ways to engage me. And having those two actors be the people who carry that plot line is a way to engage me. So it's working when it could have not.
It certainly doesn't hurt that you've got those actors delivering those lines. You could just sign me up for those actors being in a two-actor play or reading the back of a cereal box, and I would probably still find it captivating.
Okay. I think this week I'm gonna do an honorable mention. I famously did not award a best line of the episode last week. I was unhappy with the Severance episode, to be honest with you. I didn't like it. This week, good episode. Very solid hour of television. Really enjoyed it. And I think we can do an honorable mention and an awardee. The honorable mention this week is Devin talking to Mark. Mark, listen to me. Listen to me take a breath.
Ah, they're at the end.
Mark, there is literally no other option than to do what the fuck she says right now.
That's early.
For Gemma, she knows where she is, Mark. I just liked it because it was the sort of like foxhole.
Yeah.
That you get from these characters of like, I'm here objective. With you. And she's telling Kobelvig at the same time, give me a second. Don't talk to him. Don't engage with him. Let me just lock in here with him. And then she goes right back to the thing that she knows is the driving force in Mark's life now. Gemma, she knows where Gemma is. Eyes on the prize, Mark.
And it squares so perfectly with the two respective things that we both agree on, but emphasize differently when it comes to our love of this character, where it's someone that's in the trenches with you, that is willing to fight or die, that is willing to continue and fight on with you no matter the consequences, while at the same time being willing to speak honestly and directly with you in a way that nobody else will. It is the perfect mesh of the things that has given us to adore this character.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. But me coming at it from the loyalty angle, when she's like, I'm not leaving. I'm not going to let you self-destruct here, Mark. Like, I'm going to work this out with you. And I'm whatever it takes. Like, I'm here to just do it with you. Really liked it. Had an emotional reaction to that. But of course, best line of the episode was going to be probably the line of the season is devour feculence. Of course. Of fucking course it is.
What is cheerworthy moment. What does it say about us that we both agree that a very Shakespearean way of expressing eat shit is just our line of the year?
We've been waiting for the sort of heel face turn, a bad guy, a good guy turn for Milchick. And I think this is the first substantial material progress toward that.
Mm-hmm. I'm 100% there with you on both lines. Excellent choices.
Ah, look at that. United front in Mangum Talks TV today.
A rare thing. Don't get used to it, folks.
Okay. All right. Maybe I don't need to go. Yeah. I was going to maybe play off that and like, you know, really start like, some Devin Mark-esque back and forth with you. And we would just chat and really have a great time.
No, my objective in life is not to inspire you and keep you going and motivated and indicate that I'm going to be serving with you throughout any of the storms and slings and arrows that'll be coming at you in the future. My objective is to puncture your bubble so you stay grounded in real life.
Yeah, it is like when you say something like nice to me, it's like, look, Lee, I really liked that you did, but don't go overboard and do it all the time and don't say anything nice. And basically just go away right now. Just go away. I'm going to say one nice thing to you and I need you to go away.
Glorious fleeting. Glorious fleeting.
Don't overreact. All right. Any other segments, anything else you want to talk about this episode, sir?
No, again, I thought this was a really solid episode. It leaves me really excited for what's going to come in episode 10. Is it wrong to be really hopeful and really assume that episode 10 is going to knock our freaking socks off?
Yeah, I don't know I talked about this early on in our coverage of this season. I'm really trying not to get too much into the expectation games about theories and things. I'm trying not to expect big plot twists that I haven't thought of. But what I do expect, and I think it can deliver on, is progress in the plot, moving toward a place that makes sense from a cohesive narrative standpoint. And then also just a really well done well-produced episode of television, because that's what they do. They're in the wheelhouse for that. I'm not upset if I've guessed all the theories, right? That's not going to upset. I don't need a big, like, oh God, I didn't see that coming, 17 different ways removed theory from, you know, sort of unfolding in the episode. I don't need that. What I want it to do is just continue the same consistent quality production and cohesive writing that we've seen from the show.
I feel like we can trust them at this point. We've gotten so much evidence to show that this is something that they can accomplish on a weekly basis.
We agree. All right, Spencer, thank you for doing the podcast with me. Great week here at Mango Talks TV. We'll be back next week to review the finale of Severance Season 2, and we will be doing our old format. We will be going line by line through the script, all 75 minutes of it. It'll be a blast. We will see you then. Hope everybody has a great week.